Welcome to Cattle HQ, a podcast from industry experts and progressive producers discussing cutting-edge info about the cow-calf sector to keep cattlemen and women in the know and positively affect their bottom line.
All right, welcome to the Grazing Toolbox. I'm Parker Witt, and with us we have Kim Ricardo, Dave Olila, and Jalen Whaley. And Kim and I, familiar faces to the podcast, so we'll start by just letting Dave and Jalen give a brief intro about who they are, what they do, and what brings them here today. Dave, you want to start?
Well, sure. Yeah, thanks for having me, Kim and Parker. My name is Dave Olila, former ag teacher, extension specialist, and currently serving as a soil health specialist for South Dakota Soil Health Coalition. But in addition to that, we ranch east of Newell on a few thousand acres with about 300 acres of irrigated hay base, and we run about 600 ewes and 100 head of cattle. Well, we do a lot of multi-species grazing, and I played with some virtual fence and try to put that focus into some best practices that provide soil health and a functioning production system that can work into the future.
And Dave, so you had a little bit of background before an ag teacher, and you've been ranching obviously your entire life, but can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing before you're doing what you're doing now?
Well, yeah, I ended up as an ag teacher, and those that have been ag teachers know that you try to see what the needs of your community are and focus a lot of your educational emphasis into that. That'll bring jobs back and provide education for those students with the hope that they're going to come back to the rural community. And a lot of that had to do with soils and rangeland management, and obviously an interest of mine all through all that time as I was ranching. And when I had the opportunity to get into sheep extension, that was again some more of that focus. We're looking at another grazing animal to apply to the prairie, and with the idea that you're trying to mimic nature. And we look at that grazing scheme before a European man came along, and you looked at a mob grazing scenario with millions of head of buffalo with elk and antelope and deer foraging alongside that. And so a lot of that, as I come to learn, were things we were already doing. It's just that we had to put a little more thought to it to allow those animals to help us manage our rangeland resources. So not only do we improve the health, but we improve the profitability of the operation.
You know, that's a really good segue into, I guess, the overall focus of what we're kind of talking about today is multi-species systems and multi-species integration. And I guess that brings us to Jalen, if you want to jump on and kind of give the same background about who you are, where you come from, what you do. It's going to lead down the sheep direction pretty quick here, I think, but we're not just talking about sheep and cows. It's a full systems integration type conversation, and there's a whole bunch of angles that we can take on it. So what's your spin?
Yeah. So I originally grew up in northwestern Colorado, so very different climate and everything from where we're at now. But my family grew up on a small farm or ranch and had sheep and cattle primarily. We had pretty much every livestock species you can think of because dad had four girls and we all wanted different things. But grew up really focused on the show lamb side of things. We raised Suffolk Hampshire ewes and still raise some show lambs and do some direct marketing and things that my parents do. And then I went to school in Wyoming and got my master's degree under the sheep specialist there. And that's where I really developed my passion more for the commercial production flocks. He asked me to coach the wool judging team. And I said, you realize I raise blackface sheep, right? But really developed, I guess, my love for the wool industry. And so that kind of led me to now, still 5.5 years later, still trying to fill Dave's shoes as the sheep field specialist here, West River. And now my husband and I raise, we have about 600 ewes as well, fine wool, just whiteface, Western whiteface type ewes. And then we have cattle as well. And so trying to utilize our sheep and cattle in a way that, you know, this some of this Western South Dakota landscape is pretty fragile. And so how do we utilize both of those species to better our rangeland and make the most of it?
So I think a good way to take that is what we can start by talking about what are some of the main management differences that we see between cattle and sheep for an East River guy like me who is surrounded by Black Angus 24/7, and we've got plenty of sheep out here. There's some of the bigger operations in the state that we're starting to see, but it largely is cattle focused out here, and I'd like to see a lot more sheep on the landscape. But what are some of the main management differences that we see in the management styles that can be applied?
Yeah, I think from a sheep versus cattle perspective, sometimes it's a reminder that sheep and cattle aren't that different, but sheep also aren't cattle with woolly sweaters either. They have their own management styles. I would say for the most part, there's not a lot of differences other than we have to really consider more of the nutrition side of things. Think about how sheep graze, their sensitivity to copper. Their behavior when going to water, they're going to flock to water. And so, being very cognizant of our water sources, we know that cattle can bog up a dam fairly quickly. And then we get troubles with our sheep in that regard. But I think from a grazing management standpoint, a lot of the same concepts apply, but we have some unique things that we can utilize sheep for, like targeted grazing or specific weed management, those kind of things. Dave, what did I miss?
Well, you're right on track. There's a few things that are problematic when you're running sheep and cattle, and they need to be considered. And once you understand them, it's not an issue. Like water is one of them, like you described, especially in stock dams, there can be quite a struggle. So the question you end up asking a lot of times when you're running sheep with cattle or both species is, do you graze the sheep ahead of the cattle? You graze the sheep with the cattle, or do you graze them behind the cattle? And the answer is all three. You just have to figure out how it applies, because that's the uniqueness of having that diversity, is it gives you so many options to apply to that landscape. And for example, like this year coming up, we're expecting a sweet clover bloom. Well, I don't know that the moisture is going to provide that. But I've had years where that sweet clover's chest high, and so you're talking 4 or 5 feet tall, and it shades out the grass, so you lack grass production for those cattle. And the sweet clover can cause some problems with your cattle management and cattle health at the same time. So if you can see some of that coming, then you can apply a sheep grazing to that prior to. And again, you have that tool to go in and attack that sweet clover and open that canopy up so the grass can grow. And that's just an option. That's an opportunity. I don't see sweet clover or things like weeds as an issue. Those are opportunities. And the thing to remember, when I was in extension and always trying to promote sheep production, you were having people say, well, I'm not going to raise sheep or this or that. And no, you don't have to. There's a lot of young producers that are looking for a land resource. That's their limiting factor to get into production agriculture. And boy, if you can make a cooperative agreement with someone to come and graze sheep and to target some areas and open them up or do some treatments, when you understand how to use them, you can provide a whole bunch of opportunity for them and you to improve that landscape resource.
Yeah, I agree with everything you guys just said. I think, like you mentioned, Dave, I think sheep are really great and they bring a lot of opportunity to the operation. And I'm really here for some multi-species integration. So, back home, me and my sister actually got into a little bit of a sheep enterprise. We have hair sheep, which is a little different, of course, than the wool sheep we mostly see up here in South Dakota. But just seeing what that has done for our operation has been really impactful. And I think sheep complement cattle really well, like you guys mentioned. They're not cows and there are some differences, but at the same time, there are also a lot of similarities. And I think in terms of, forage utilization, they really improve that aspect of the operation. And it's really nice because, while sheep and cattle do have some overlap in terms of the forages they prefer, they also have some differences. And so we just are able to maximize that forage use a little better. And I think, one thing we kind of hear, and Dave mentioned this a little bit, is you tend to hear a lot of negativity around implementing sheep or adding sheep to the enterprise. And so what are some things that you guys have kind of noticed have been some big concerns, I guess, or some common comments people have as to why they're not interested in adding sheep to the operation?
I think the first thing we hear is fencing. I don't know, Dave, maybe there's another big one, but I feel like that's usually people's biggest concern is that, well, I don't have the fence that can hold the sheep. And they're under the impression that it takes woven wire absolutely 100% to hold sheep. And that's just not true. We do run a 6-wire fence, which is more than most cattle producers. Yes, maybe an extra wire, but even on the like if we're going to do some temporary fencing and utilize electric fence, even though, I mean, again, we could use one polywire cows, but it only takes two polywires with sheep, which again is kind of a common misconception, I think. And so it doesn't have to be near the capital investment that I think people think that it's going to be, or the headache either. They will stay behind the fence, I promise.
So I only say this because I can see Dave's wearing the Soil Coalition hat right now, and we're talking about developing grazing agreements with people in the area. So I've got to plug the Grazing Exchange, which for those of you who aren't aware, I refer to it, it's match.com for livestock. You can go online to the Soil Coalition website, click on the link, and it'll give you a map of everybody in your area who has forage to graze, livestock that they want to be utilizing for grazing, and everything in between. And it's just a phenomenal resource we'd like to get out there for people. But in your guys' experience, when you're developing these grazing agreements with people, one of the bigger things that we run into around here is the infrastructure issue. Who's in charge of developing that fence? Is it a 6-wire? Is it 2-wire poly? Are you going full woven? What's that situation look like? How does water factor into it? So, how you guys have seen it in the past, and you've got much more experience than we do in this field, what are some of the commonalities that you've seen folks take on, and how do they like to arrange these different grazing agreements?
Yeah, so you guys, SBSU Extension has a great publication that can be found on the website regarding grazing agreements and some of those scenarios. So you might bring that link up at some time, Parker, to help give people some background. But it's whatever two parties want to agree to in the division of labor and expectations, and those should always be brought out beforehand. For example, on cropland, the cropland owner has some concerns of compaction and pugging and some of those things. And then grassland owners have concerns of overuse and overgrazing. So those need to be considered. When you talk about infrastructure, it's all in how you want to make that deal. We know that cycling nutrients through livestock, sheep and cattle, goats, adds to soil improvement. So that landowner needs to see that as a manure spreader that's going to help, provided you do it right. The person bringing in the livestock is benefiting because of the grazing resource and how that provides nutrition and growth and development to what they're doing. So you've got to identify what your goals are and then apply your grazing to meet those goals. And again, chemical versus grazing in invasive species management can be a huge opportunity there. And we have some publications, again, that would help support those ideas. But yeah, you have to, with anything, it doesn't matter if it's rented land or your own land, you've got to consider some of those logistics. They're not deal breakers. Water and fencing are not deal breakers. They're just problematic, and you've got to figure them out and who's going to bear that burden. But at the same time, do a cost benefit ratio on how that imp helps the landowner versus the livestock owner.
Yeah, that's solid advice. I'll pull the publications after this and make sure that we get those tagged in. And you've kind of piqued my curiosity a little bit, not to circle back too far, but you're talking about using sheep to graze off sweet clover. And I assume that you were talking about that before running cattle out there so that you can open up the canopy and get better grass production. But have you ever experienced, or you know anybody who has experience in using sheep or any other kind of, I'll say, alternatives to cattle as a prescriptive grazer to go in as a cooperative grazing agreement with somebody who has an existing cattle pasture to work on some of those problems. So like sweet clover and smooth brome are two that come to the front of my mind right now. They're kind of a double-edged sword because a lot of folks are proponents for them, and then a lot of folks are actually trying to shy away from that for different pasture renovations. But what kind of experience do you have in that world?
Well, this is nothing new. Understand that. This is old practices being brought back again and applied in a way that we want to set our goals. And yeah, like you say, smooth brome and sweet clover can be looked at as a benefit or as an effort to control because of the negatives that they possess. But it's all in how you want to approach that. From a livestock point of view, I see it as forage and again, opportunity to utilize. Livestock are a very effective way of managing those types of things. And we have out in our country, especially on the heavy clay soils, sweet clover seems to do very well when we have exceptionally wet years. It's a biennial and will start in the summer before. And then you can see it out there. That first year growth is hiding out under the grass. And so you can predict that easily to plan for the next year and say, oh, I'm going to focus here. And that's what I'm doing. It's just that I'm suspecting that because we're so short of rainfall this year, that sweet clover is probably going to get a foot tall and then start shooting a seed head and then go back. But that's okay. We'll utilize it when we can. And because of that opportunity, it allows me to rest other pastures, especially in the native ones in drought years. The longer you can allow them to develop roots and get through a drought, the more resilience you're going to create in that system. As far as scenarios, yes, there are folks even in the targeted grazing handbooks that Jalen has access to. The Perman Ranch cooperated with a sheep producer over by Watertown, and they brought in a band of sheep. A band is 800 to 1,000 head and a herder. And they did that over several years. And the goal was to graze leafy spurge and western snowberry, which were their nemesis there in central South Dakota. The sheep owner paid a lease to graze there, but it was discounted. And at the same time, the landowner, because they didn't have to use chemical applications plus their labor to control that those invasive species, had a win-win. They both had income coming in, and then they didn't have any chemical inputs going out. So it provides a great story and an effective way to control invasive species and turn it into red meat.
Well, and if I can add something in there on permits, I think what was kind of the most eye-opening to me when I first started in Extension and got to go visit their place was their emphasis on the fact that they didn't have to increase their land resources. On the exact same amount of land, they were now running, I think it was at that time, 300 head of cows plus 1,000 head of ewes. And so with land prices just continuing to rise and that kind of being, like Dave mentioned earlier, everybody's barrier to entry, I think that's where sheep provide a really awesome opportunity to have another enterprise, improve your pasture land, as well as not have to make a huge land investment to do so.
That feels like a really good way to help people take on some of these integrated practices, especially if they don't actually have a band of sheep that they can use themselves and developing these grazing arrangements. What are some other logical steps that you guys can think of for anybody who might be interested in taking on something like this or getting multi-species grazing on their landscape?
I'll just put in a little bit, and then Jalen can jump on. Understand that the wool sheep in this country naturally fit this environment, so there's no effort in bringing them on. We're in a number of ways. The climate, they can survive the climate, winter and summer. They will produce a wool product that is highly desired globally, not just in the U.S. or regionally, globally. These wools are sought after because of their length and strength and their yields. And so we're naturally doing this without a lot of effort. And folks kind of forget some of those things. So why are we fighting it? Our rangelands out west here are 80% grass and 20% forbs and shrubs. So the old rule is you can run one ewe and her lamb behind one cow and her calf. without competition, then you're balancing your grazing pressure. So a lot of it just has to do with want to and understanding how you can better manage your land resource. Again, back to improving the land resource, but in increasing profitability.
Well, and I've been working with a producer now for several years that doesn't actually own sheep year round. He kind of watches the markets and has really studied what they do and has started buying yearling ewes in the April, May timeframe because he's targeting leafy spurge here in the hills. And then he sells those ewes in September, October. So he has very little input cost into those ewes other than purchasing them in the spring. And then gets the benefit of running them and improving his pastures, and then goes ahead and sells them as mature ewes that are ready to breed and people are going to want. And so I think there's opportunity that you don't necessarily have to jump in and get a flock and do the whole lambing thing and all of that all at once. Like you can take baby steps into it and run them, kind of like summer stockers or something like that as well. I think there's opportunity there.
Mentioned something that I find really interesting and I agree with, and that is, that the wool sheep is really bred for this environment. And I, of course, have a bias somewhat towards the hair sheep just because that's what I have back home. But I think, like you mentioned, we're in a drier environment that those wool sheep maybe don't have as many parasite issues as they might compared to where I'm from, and things like that. But could you guys kind of touch base on, what are some differences between wool and hair sheep? Is there one that you think is better than the other? And also, what are some marketability differences between those species or breeds that producers should consider?
Yeah, even though, like I said, we raise wool sheep, the hair sheep are growing in popularity across the US and in South Dakota. And the more I learn about them, the more intrigued I am with them. I think, especially like where you're from, Kim, or they're growing a lot in eastern South Dakota, where we do have a little bit more humid environment. We struggle to keep that wool quality up. In a lot of parts of the US, they have more struggles to find qualified shears, which we're very fortunate here in Western South Dakota, and really the Intermountain West of the US that we have good shearing crews. But you're exactly right, Kim. The Katahdin breed, the Dorper breed, some of those hair sheep are more parasite resistant. And so that is a huge benefit, or a huge reason that people are moving to hair sheep. That's not to say that they'll never get parasites, because I've definitely seen, worm troubles in hair sheep as well. But it is, for some people, it's one less thing to worry about, is the shearing costs and potentially having to deworm them. But I'll also, on both sides of the industry, there's a genetic component to that as well, and the industry is doing a really good job in specific breeds of capturing how do we estimate breeding values for parasite resiliency. But yeah, I think, I don't know, I guess whether you're a hair sheep breeder or a wool sheep breeder, our industry is seeking growth and we're growing rapidly. And so I don't think it's a hair sheep versus a wool sheep thing. From a marketability standpoint, you mentioned that as well. There are some nuances for sure, but we're seeing the ethnic market really ties into those hair sheep. They finish at a much lighter weight, which is what most of our ethnic consumers want. They don't want the 145, 150 pound traditional wool type sheep that we have. And so you do have some better marketing opportunity. Those lambs finish faster. You have the opportunity to capitalize on some alternative markets because they're more aseasonal in their breeding pattern than our most of our hair sheep, or excuse me, our wool sheep. And so there's definitely some market opportunities, I think, on both sides of the fence. We're in a really good position in the sheep industry right now. The wool market's good, the lamb market's good, and so either way, you're in a good spot right now.
There seems to be like you said, a lot of opportunity right now, and I think in a lot of times, sheep can be more profitable than cattle just because oftentimes they require a little less inputs or at least a little less labor. And I do want to share a little story, I guess, about my personal sheep. You mentioned that, the hair sheep can still have some parasite troubles, and I found that out the rough way this year. So I have I've never had to worm them. You know, they had some genetic resistance to them. And then this year back home, we've gotten a lot of moisture. And so it's been super wet and, of course, had some parasite troubles. But I also think it's important to recognize that grazing management can also play into that. You know, if you're utilizing good rotational grazing practices, that can kind of help decrease some of that parasite impact. And then also, another benefit to or complement with sheep and cattle is that cattle kind of break up that parasite cycle in sheep. Is that something you guys have kind of also noticed, or maybe, you know, working with some of those hair sheep producers that also have cattle, is that something that they mention as well up here in South Dakota?
Well, you need to be careful about that because I think some of the jury's still out on that, and I would say that there needs to be more research. There are some parasites that will be shared between sheep and cattle, so we need to keep that in mind. And then, again, I'm going to bring back, because I'm with Soil Health, trying to mimic nature when you are grazing livestock. And if you continue to repeatedly graze the same grass, and they're going to defecate on it, you're going to have a parasite issue. And nature didn't work that way. Nature migrated. And so those animals did not regraze on the same plants. And that's where you're running into parasites. That's how they continue to proliferate. So we have wool sheep, and they're traditional white-faced breeds, and we don't have a parasite issue. We've lessened any need for that just because of the way we graze. And that means we are not in the same spot for more than 3 weeks so that they can regraze a plant. We're moving usually weekly. We get in the middle of summer when plants slow down in their growth, and we're at 2 weeks. But we've solved the problem by going back to nature and trying to understand how did nature manage parasites. And I think we just get lost in some of those ideas that, and different production systems have an idea that you're going to throw them on a high rainfall area and regraze it. Well, you're going to have a parasite issue because that's not how nature works. And so if we can step back and look at some of those things as a holistic system and how we introduce this animal into that environment so that it can have good nutrition and be healthy, then we can lessen a lot of inputs. And just one little extra piece I'll share on that. Our city cousins want that story. And you've heard me say that before, that we are being a solution to our environmental woes. We are not being the problem or the cause. And that's where livestock on the landscape have a purpose and part of that solution. And that needs to continually be retold so folks understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. And I think that's, you know, one of Parker and I's goals for this podcast is to try to get that information out there, try to tell producer stories about their operations to kind of help bridge that gap. I do have one more question, or I guess one more comment per se about hair sheep versus wool sheep, and this is probably more so for selfish reasons. But I was actually talking to a producer here in Central South Dakota who used to have wool sheep, has now gotten to the hair sheep, has Katahdin sheep, and he was saying, you know, that he really noticed a difference in fertility. You know, I believe he said he had only two open ewes this year, didn't have to get them up in lamb in jugs, let them lamb on pasture or rangeland. Do you guys have any thoughts or comments about that as well? Maybe some differences that producers should consider when thinking about integrating sheep?
I'll caution you on all of that because that word of mouth stuff, I can replicate anything they claim on a hair sheep on a wool sheep. I mean, it's a management thing. I don't think it's as breed specific as it is management. And again, on the wool side, we have an infrastructure out here we need to take advantage of. And I'm getting over $5 a pound for my wool because of my soil health story and what it does. Well, if I'm averaging 10 pounds of wool, that's $50 a head I'm getting that a hair sheep guy isn't. And I can get pretty close to 170 to 200% lamb crop. So I think you just have to look at what you are trying to do what your goals are with some of that, and get the animal that best fits what your purposes are. When I was working with in extension on the hair sheep side, because of their frame size is so small, they don't fit the traditional meat industry pipeline. So they are harder to sell when they are finished animals if you're not hitting an ethnic market. And so you will take a discount there. So I always encourage people, and it's with any enterprise you get into, you need to go find your customer before you start producing. It doesn't matter if it's grain or hay, cattle or sheep. You need to find that outlet and what they're looking for, and then try to build toward that.
Dave, I've heard your story a couple of times about the wool prices that you're getting right now because of your stories through the Soil Health Coalition and managing your land and your herds with a land ethic. And that's one of the things that we hear a whole bunch of people ask about, and it's usually related to things like direct market opportunities. But how did you take that opportunity and run with it to be able to share your story and get the word out and then capitalize on it going forward?
Well, I didn't set out to sell the wool that way. It's my goal has always been that we need, again, you heard me say it before, we need to get the word out that we as people in production agriculture are a solution to environmental woes. And our city cousins don't hear that. They see us as polluters and contaminators and millionaires because we hold so much in assets that they do not see us as the poor farmer or rancher that's just trying to raise a family. So we have our perceptions have to be considered in a lot of ways. And so fortunately, being involved with Soil Health Coalition and the Grassland Coalition, they have featured a number of producers in South Dakota that are working with that land ethic. And our ranch happened to be one of them. And in that case, a wool mill saw that. And they reached out to us, and then we made that relationship because they want to be able to use our story to sell their yarn. And that's perfect. That's ideal because it not only helps them, but it's helping us sell our story because I'm more thinking about the next generations of agriculturalists and how can they operate in a way that's going to allow them not to live in crisis, but to see profitability, not richness, but just profitability to raise their families, enjoy what they're doing, provide something for the strength of this country because we know our best national security is a cheap, safe, abundant food supply. And those are the messages we need to get out and the practices we need to promote for the next generations of agriculturalists to serve this country and serve themselves.
That's definitely the story of all agriculture right now, and it's a story that we're hoping through this podcast to be able to get out to as many people. I mean, we for a short period of time thought about naming the podcast "Make Farming Fun Again," but that felt a little bit too political for us to go with. So obviously, we couldn't go that direction. Talking about that national security concern of making sure that we have the cheap, abundant food source and hoping to see these practices expand on the landscape. With that, obviously, there's going to be a lot of risk that's associated with it. What are some management techniques or tips that you might have for somebody who's interested in getting into any kind of diversification to help manage the risk as they take on diversification?
Well, I'm gonna say it the other way. With these practices, you're actually minimizing risk. You're lessening your boom and bust situations based on environment, rainfall and lack thereof. But also, you've diversified your income streams and enterprises, so you're not banking on one enterprise to bring in that return. And we've just been sold too many different formulas that create a dependency on especially fossil fuels when we start talking about chemicals, fertilizer, and diesel fuel. And anything we can do to lessen those dependencies and manage our environment so it can be resilient to what comes as far as rainfall and not, we not only can ensure ourselves of an average production. Forage production that's always available that we can operate with, but we're also improving the health of our animals too because their nutrition's better. So if you take that holistic point of view, Yeah, it's a lot of moving pieces and a lot of parts, and it's a whole different way of looking at how you do agriculture. But in the end, it's going to provide you a consistent outcome that you can have some predictions on. And it's going to take some time, and it's happening that we educate the rest of the infrastructure, which would include bankers and ag supply dealers, on how we're going to do agriculture in the future.
I feel like I'm the oddball out here in this podcast because I'm an agronomist by trade. The livestock side of things is still somewhat of a novel concept to me, and I like to tell people the story that the best piece of agriculture advice I ever received when I was going through my early days of training in college, taking internships, actually came from a financial advisor who knew absolutely nothing about the ag world, livestock, crops, and it was advice that they were giving me on diversifying my portfolio and the consistencies that we see between the livestock and the agronomy world and the diversification that we have when the financial world. It certainly shows through, and it's something that I always preach out to anybody who's interested in any kind of agricultural setting, is that you can't put all of your eggs into one basket and expect that to pay out dividends year in, year out. You're going to need to have some sort of diversification to be able to pad yourself against any kind of volatility that we see in the market. So, in my world, it coming from the row crop side of things, we'd see corn and bean farmers try to take on slightly more diverse rotations, including small grains, including cover crops, including, annual forage grazing and all sorts of other livestock integrative topics. And it's what really led me down the path that I am that puts me here today. And one of the topics that I wanted to hit on during this, and we may be running out of time here, but there's a big difference between East River grazing and West River grazing on native range versus planted annual forage systems or even planted perennial forage systems, which we see quite a few of in the eastern side of the state. Is there anything that you guys want to throw in on just some of the observations you've seen on those type systems and how they can be managed and manipulated to hit on some of the topics that we've already talked about?
Dave can talk on some of this probably a lot better than I can. I would say at the end of the day, all of our grazing management, our standard practices all apply regardless of where you're at in the state. Where we're at, we assume 20 to 30 acres to run an AUM. East River, it's a little bit smaller than that. So even though our climates are different, our production is different, as long as we're still applying those same soil health and grazing management practices, we're still going to be benefiting the environments that we live in. And I would love to see some more research on the sheep integration on some of our cover crops, or even I think I get more and more questions every year on grazing stubble or things like that. But I'll turn it over to Dave because Dave has personally done a lot more of that and worked with a lot of other producers that are doing more of that crop livestock integration.
Thanks, Jalen. Yeah, there's so much opportunity there that it's ridiculous that people are missing that. For example, when I got into cover crops, they were always pushed as a soil improvement. But when you start utilizing cover crops, let's say you've taken a grain hay off or an annual, and then you've got this bare ground, and we want to cover it, so we put cover crops on. And then come October is when I breed, and here's these cover crops that are 2 to 3 feet tall, and they're vegetative. And so I sampled them for nutrient analysis, and we're looking at 17 to 20% protein availability with high TDN issues or energy opportunities. And so I dumped those ewes in there. And again, talking about fertility, boom, sheep are so adaptive and responsive to environment that dropping those ewes into that changed their fertility because there's a nutrient source there telling them physiologically, oh, you're living in the Garden of Eden. You can handle two or three lambs. If they were still on native prairie that's dried out, their body's going to tell them, oh, you're hardly able to keep yourself alive. You're only going to get one. That's a game changer for sheep producers to be able to have that opportunity to drop into what we would call a flushing scenario in the fall. The other thing is, again, I'm running cows with these sheep, and we're coming off of native grass that's dropped in its nutrient value, punched it into these cover crops, their milk production goes back up, plus the calves are grazing this, so you're getting a better growth rate there. And then you run into another situation where you have to think about, okay, in December or January, when I'm going to wean these calves, I've got to back off that cow's nutrition because I'm going to have some other issues if I don't. Again, it's not a deal breaker. You just have to understand a different way of managing those. But the cover crop thing and some of those forage opportunities that we're missing out, winter wheats are wonderful grazing, and ryes and triticales, any of those winter annuals provide an opportunity there too that's unmatched. And again, you're cycling nutrients right back to the soil that have all the biology from the rumen that, oh, coincidentally, that's the same biology you find in the soil. Those aren't accidents, and you're just inoculating your soil with better biology. So away you go.
I got to mention it because it seems like the entire state right now is experiencing drought through and through, especially down in the south and the southwest part of the state. And one of the big things that we're seeing a lot of, and we're getting a lot of questions about with some of these annual forage systems in particular, are some of the grazing concerns that largely geared towards cattle, but some of the grazing concerns that come with some of these cooler season annual forages or your winter wheats, your ryes. And a lot of it revolves around nitrate issues and having forage that's too hot, and the rumen might not be quite up to the task of grazing on that, especially if you put hungry cattle out there. But do we see the same type of issues with sheep, or are there other concerns that should be considered as well?
I would say they say that sheep aren't as sensitive to nitrate toxicity, but I have yet to find a hard and fast number that says that. So I still think we should explore the same precautions if you're gonna run sheep on a system like that. The other thing I've worked with producers on, I guess in my experience more so than with some of these forages that we've talked about, is grazing alfalfa, and which is kind of a cool thing that we can do with sheep, especially as Dave mentioned, is some kind of a flushing ration. But if we can still utilize those same concepts, don't turn hungry sheep out on those pastures. I know some people that have utilized, turning them out for a few hours and slowly working that rumen to where it can handle those hotter forages, providing a free choice, low quality hay while on those pastures, things like that. So yeah, the same concepts do still apply for sheep, I would say.
So Kim and I, about a month ago, went out and we visited Dave and just got a tour around his operation a little bit. One of the things, Dave, that you were showing us was the interseeding that you have of alfalfa into some of your pasture land out there. I got to assume that it's to hit some of these same points that Jalen just brought up. You mind talking through that really quick?
Yeah, the whole host of reasons of interseeding alfalfa, both from soil health points of view and animal nutrition. And obviously, Jalen is exactly right on. You are going to turn livestock into these high nutrition or high hot feeds like nitrate heavies. You need to build them up to them. And one of the rules I always shared that I grew up with was, if you've got nitrate or suspect nitrate feeds, you never solely feed that or graze that. Like Jalen was saying, you put out other feed that they can go balance their diet with. And you've got to have a belief that animals can do that. They've been living on their own for thousands of years, so they will balance their diet. But if they've only got one choice of food source, you're going to put yourself into a risky situation. And that's the same way with alfalfa too. If they're accustomed to it, you can graze it. But the beauty thing about alfalfa, the high protein source, and what does the protein feed? It feeds the biology in the rumen. And what does the rumen digest? High cellulose fiber. And what do we have in some of our range plants? High cellulose fiber, especially in crested wheatgrass, that they don't want to consume when it matures and it leaches out a lot of its nutrients. And here's an opportunity that those animals are looking for gut fill because the biology in the rumen's calling for it and they're loose. So they want to slow down their digestive pass-through rates. And so you're getting them to consume a forage they wouldn't normally consume because you interseeded that alfalfa. Well, and then alfalfa, by the way, is a legume. So you just put nitrogen in the soil. And what plants love nitrogen? Grass. So you've just improved your production and you've actually increased more tillering in your grass plants. So you've increased the production there and you've got more plant cover. You've got better nutrition for your livestock. And the thing just starts to snowball. And it's just taking some time to think about how we want to improve our soil landscape.
Absolutely. Dave, I really appreciate how you really encourage everyone to think about these things from a whole systems perspective. How do the management decisions we make impact the big picture, the land, the soil, the profitability, et cetera? I guess I have one last question for you too. If there was, a specific management change or practice that you could tell producers to implement tomorrow with little extra, cost or inputs, what would that be?
I feel like based on our conversation today, it's at a small remnant. obviously, Dave and I are always going to promote that. But I think the big takeaway is taking a step back and figuring out, kind of like what Parker was talking about, what is that diversification option that you have that makes the most sense to you? And I also think sometimes it can be intimidating, but just like our conversations here today and the team we have, everybody in agriculture is willing to step up and help you. And so, regardless of whether you want to incorporate sheep or goats or whatever that diversification looks like for your operation, find somebody else doing it and don't be afraid to ask lots of questions. Obviously, I'm going to put a plug in for us in Extension as well, and Dave with the Soil Health Coalition. Like, there's folks out there that are willing to help you. And so, figuring out how to diversify your operation for, to Dave's point, the next generation, that's really the purpose of what we're doing. That would be my thing, is don't be afraid to take the leap. And it doesn't have to be jumps and big steps to start with. It can start small.
Yep, that's a good point, Jalen. It's mastering a craft, and you are not going to gather all that in a year. That's you talk to these folks and find those resources, because we do, fellow ranchers, we want you to be successful and continue on. And so they're there with how they've done it and suggestions, and then you've just got to apply it to your environment. We talked about grazing East River versus West River. The rules are the same. It's just the production and how your environment acts that you've got to adjust to, and know when to use, when to graze heavy, when to graze light, what animals to use at what times. Those are things you just keep asking questions, and every year is going to be different. So that becomes that one word thing is flexibility. But you provide yourself opportunity by putting in the structure of how you're going to approach that.
That's all great advice. It all truly starts with taking the first step. Is there any upcoming Extension sheep events, Jalen, you want to mention, and any South Dakota Soil Health Coalition events, Dave, that might be beneficial to our listeners?
So actually, Dave and I are working together on a event in the middle of June. June 11th, we'll be out at Dave's place, looking at some forage differences and some of those grazing management practices when it comes to sheep and cattle. And so that'll be June 11th. And then I'll put a plug in for all of us, since we're speaking at, I guess, those of us in Extension, Kim and Parker, at the South Dakota annual yearling ewe sale in Huron at Magnus Livestock at 10 o'clock. We're going to have some Extension educational programming all centered around sheep production, and then free lunch and the yearling ewe sale to follow. So those would be, I think, the most recent Extension events coming up.
And for the soil health, we'll have a soil health school the 24th and 25th of June at the Dry Creek Ranch, which is Sean and Christy Freeland's. It's about 8 miles east of Rapid there in Caputa. So you can get on the South Dakota Soil Health Coalition website and register for that. I think it's $100 or $125, but that is on the ground, getting your hands dirty. School to understand how to apply all these practices we've been talking about. Sean runs cattle, sheep, and hogs, and they're all out on pasture, plus he does the cover crops and all those things. So everything we've talked about here will come up at that school too.
Lots of good events coming up, building the community. I like to see the direction this is going. So everything we just talked about, we can find on the Soil Health Coalition, excuse me, the South Dakota Soil Health Coalition's website, and then the SDSU Extension website as well. We'll make sure that those links are widely available. for all of us here, this has been the Grazing Toolbox. Thank you for tuning in, and we will talk to you next time.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. We invite you to visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, as well as subscribe to the show on Spotify. You will also find show notes and resources from today's episode. Until next time, remember, success is not a goal, it's a byproduct.